Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're off, and we're doing it. We're here, and once again, Fan Club is live. Oh, God.
It is live for us. Always live
it is,
for us.
It's always live, and I never listen to it back, because, life's...
Even in lockdown, it would be too much, wouldn't it? It would be too much to spend.
You know what? I hear enough of my voice, or one of my voices, all week long, all day, every day. I don't need to block it out with more of my voice. So, yeah. Okay, cool. So we saw each other this week, didn't we?
We did. We had an outside meeting, which we're allowed to do now. It's the new normal. So I cycled up to yours. Absolutely exhausted myself. Spent most of the time dreading going back because I didn't want to go back to make the return journey. No. But it was good to see you. Very nice to see you.
But we've done all of our talking this week, so
yeah, we've already spoken about all our stuff, so I guess we'll see you all next week.
See you all next
Friday at 12. See ya.
Anyway, so you're listening to Five Star Family Fun Size Fan Club. Mm-hmm. Thank you for tuning in. First rule of Fan Club, tell your friends about Fan Club. Simple as that, isn't it? Simple.
Same one.
First rule of Fan Club, tell your friends about Fan Club. Maybe we should get our guests to say that. Yeah. I'm spitballing here, but like maybe it would be good to have someone turn and point to the camera and say, tell your friends about Fan Club.
Yeah. We could get that. We could get them to do little idents for us, couldn't they? Saying, hey, you're listening to Fan Club. Assuming it's an American guest.
Yeah, we should actually get Natalie to sort that out. So make a note to tell her once this is finished, because I don't know if she listens anymore. Oh, well. We are truly alone. So here we are. I'm having a weird day. So here we are. Okay, I'm going to get in the zone. I'm going to get in the zone that it can only be reached.
But for the benefit of the listeners, we are starting later than we normally would to accommodate our guests this week. So normally we'd do it at start at 2, but today we're starting at 4. So it's much later in the day for us than we've got. It's post-lunch. We're going to be going right up till 6. So for us, even though not for you if you're listening live, but you can listen to it when you like if you're listening on the podcast, this is almost like the drive time slot, FUBAR drive time.
Well, this feels like a sleepy afternoon now, which is great for me because as soon as this finishes, I'm going to switch everything off and go straight to bed and then not think about anything until tomorrow.
Best way.
It's the best way to do it. Well, we're allowed out to see people now, aren't we?
Yeah.
First, okay, let's do this again. Right. And we're off. Okay, here we are. Hello, my name's Nick Helm, and I'm joined by
Nathaniel Metcalf.
And you're listening to Five Star Family Fun Size Fan Club. Here we go. Here, Fan Club. I mean, what? Okay. We'll do it like that. Tell your friends.
Yeah.
And then, second rule of Fan Club is please.
For the love of
all that is holy on this cursed earth, please tell your friends. So, Nathaniel,
yes,
what have you been a fan of this week?
What have I been a fan of? I have seen a bunch of stuff. I know one of the things we were sort of talking about the other day was the Coming to America sequel that I liked a lot.
Well, let's pretend that we didn't meet.
Coming to America, Nick. Coming to America.
Coming to
the sequel
America.
To Coming to America.
Yeah.
I was a fan of that this week. It's a new film sequel on Amazon Prime.
Well, that's good.
So you can all see that.
Is there anything else that you saw this week?
I saw a really great film, actually, called The Incident.
That sounds like you're now saying that Coming to America wasn't really that great.
I thought it was good. I thought it was exactly what I wanted. I didn't feel like it was a great, great film.
Well,
and I felt like it was sort of, I felt all it really was like a series of callbacks to the first film. But because I liked the first film, I enjoyed it all. Like I sort of loved it. I kind of, it was everything I wanted out of a sequel. And it was, but I could also say, look, hand on heart, I couldn't say like it's a well-made film or it's really like well put together. But the fact, I just really liked seeing all the characters again, really liked all the callbacks to the first film, really liked how much effort they'd gone to. I really liked Eddie Murphy in it. I liked how he'd, how sort of how egoless it seemed and how loads of other cast members got big kind of funny comic moments and it didn't feel like he had to be the star of it. I really enjoyed it. Really liked seeing the characters again. I thought it was a lot of fun. But then it's sort of like, it's not like, it doesn't feel like a good film because it is just, it just exists to sort of, but I mean, in a way, it's probably a really good sequel because it's a bit of a tick box of moments from the first one repeated and seeing a lot of the same faces from the first one again. But I really liked it. Mm. Did you see Coming to America?
Yes, I did. Thank you for asking. I did see it. Well, it's everywhere, isn't it? And everyone is posting these posts about how nostalgic and wonderful it is to see everyone back together again, which is nice. It's nice that people are united by that. Saw coming the original Coming to America probably for the first time all the way through last year. Uh-huh. I remember distinctly in the 90s I had some friends over and we were staying up to watch the Oscars, and at about midnight Paramount Comedy was showing Coming to America and it was on in the background while we were sort of like drinking. And I've seen bits and pieces. I grew up being a big John Landis fan, American Werewolf, Blues Brothers, Animal House, you know.
American Werewolf in London.
Didn't I say that first?
Oh, did you?
Pretty sure I did.
Oh, okay.
But if not, my mind isn't working properly. But Three Amigos, like I've always thought that John Landis is a sort of a bit of he has directorial quirks that he adds into all of his films. Like he does people looking at the camera, Trading Places. He has people looking at the camera. He has to punctuate a joke. He has like. See you next Wednesday, signs everywhere. He has like little things that make John Landis. He always has sort of like a R&B or soul sort of like soundtrack. And there's little things that kind of like let you know that it's a John Landis film. But as a filmmaker, he is a fairly basic filmmaker. We were sort of talking about this the other day, but like when you look at someone like Kevin Smith, who he sort of like, he just refused to learn as a filmmaker.
Yeah.
And so you see his early films and they're great. They're very sort of like basic, rough around the edges. And you're kind of like, this is a guy that's learning how to make films. Very sort of like simple locked off shots. But it's enough because the stories are simple enough to sort of like get across what he's trying to do. And yeah, that's fantastic. And then later on you see kind of like, the Jay and Silent Bob reboot, and you realize he hasn't improved at all as a filmmaker in all of this time. And that's kind of his fault. You know, he hasn't. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly what you mean. I think he would probably be the first to admit that as well.
I think he's
aware of his own limitations.
I think he would, but I find that frustrating because you go, you're aware of your limitations, but you haven't. Do you know what I mean? You've got all of this at your disposal. When you look at like John Landis, a lot of his shots are very kind of like simplistic. He will edit on Like, if, as an example, he will edit after someone's spoken. So there'll be like a dialogue scene between two or three people. And when the person is talking, the camera will be on them. And then when the person stops talking, it will go to the next person that's talking. And then it'll go back again. And there's no sort of like real flow to a lot of his dialogue scenes. Which is incredible because he also directed the car chase scene in Blues Brothers.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
You know,
yeah.
Which is a very complicated set, but I think a lot of that would be kind of like, where do you want the cameras? We've got as much, we're doing it for real. So we don't have like the fantasy land of creating something in a computer and then digitally placing the cameras afterwards. It's kind of like you go, you know, you've got one shot at film in this car chase. Or this car crash. So, you know, place the cameras, and then a lot of it's up to the stunt team. I'm not taking anything away from John Landis because I really loved his films growing up. But even stuff like, even like his masterpieces, like American Werewolf in London, it's kind of like, I think it's the humour and the characters and Rick Baker's special effects that really elevate it. Mm-hmm. But in terms of filmmaking, there's the bit when they're being chased across the Yorkshire Moors at the beginning, and it's basically it's a series of sort of like, I don't know whether it's a dolly shot or because they're on the moors, whether it's handheld or maybe it's Steadicam, but you've got basically a series of shots of your main two characters walking from the left side of the screen to the right side of the screen while the camera follows them, and then when they sort of like run out of room, they cut to another shot of them going from the left side of the screen to the right side of the screen to the left side of the screen to the right side of the screen. And they just repeat these shots over and over again. And so in terms of kind of like sophisticated filmmaking, and I don't think it really matters in a lot of those cases, but in terms of sophisticated filmmaking, I think that it's kind of lacking. I would also argue that when I was growing up, I had American Werewolf in London and The Thing, John Carpenter's The Thing on VHS that I wore out. You know, I watched them over and over again, and the tapes just wore out. But I would sort of argue the same thing about John Carpenter, is that a lot of his shots are very simple. But in rewatching John Carpenter, when you watch them on Blu-ray, and you watch like really nice transfers of his stuff, I think there is a lot going on in John Carpenter's films. They are quite they're fairly simplistic the way that they're put. But I think that's more like, I feel like that's a visual style.
Yeah.
Whereas with John Landis, I feel like it's sort of like a limitation. So anyway, so here's the thing. Lifelong Eddie Murphy fan, especially 80s Eddie Murphy. I say that, I liked him in the 90s as well. I'm of the belief that Bowfinger was probably Eddie Murphy and Steve Martin's last great film. And good for them. They, you know, they've made enough films. I love every time Eddie Murphy makes film, but I've seen enough of his bad ones to sort of like know the difference. Really liked Dolomite Is My Name last year. And Coming to America, even though it's John Landis, even though it's Eddie Murphy, I've never, not like never liked it. I think it's just an incredibly likeable film. It's never grabbed me in the same way that Trading Places grabbed me, or Beverly Hills Cop, or even Beverly Hills Cop 3. I think Nutty Professor's a really great film in terms of he's great in it. It's an amazing performance. So Coming to America is kind of like, it's this odd film where it starts off with one of the all-time greatest shots. It's just like this camera sweeping through these lush green hills of Africa with this African music going on over it. And it's just this really long shot of the camera flying through Africa. And then it lands on a shot of the palace. And it's like, oh, my God. And then it goes down to basic setup shots of people talking and then cutting and then people talking. So, and there's like a few jokes at the beginning of the original Coming to America, which are funny. When he's having a bath and there's the personal, the royal penis washer and all of this stuff. And you go, yeah, yeah, yeah. And like his... And then I just find, like, it's just a series of perfunctory scenes with just really, really, really likeable characters. Really sort of like, you know where you are with the setup and the scenario. It's a prince that has to go to, an African prince has to go to Queens and pretend to be. And I just feel like the film, weirdly, just as simple as it is, never really pays off. So I don't have any nostalgia for this film because I never grew up watching it. And I feel like it doesn't pay off on its premise. And I don't find it... It's not that I don't find it funny. It's that I can't see where the jokes are. I can't even tell where it's trying to be funny. I'll watch a scene and then it will come to the end of the scene and then you'll go, okay. And there'll be opportunities to make laughs because a lot of it is based, basically it's a farce with lots of people pretending to be other people and then going through a room, pretend to be someone else or not letting someone into their apartment because they can't see where they live. And it's kind of like, it's like classic farcical setups, but they don't really sort of like pay off on any of that. And so, you know, okay, it's great. So Eddie Murphy made kind of like this all black, sort of fairy tale romantic comedy, and it was one of like one of the first big huge budget blockbusters of that kind, and so that's obviously a really great thing. But then beyond that, it's kind of like, I don't feel like there are any jokes in that. Even like the character that he plays when he's doing like the sexual chocolate bit, I can't remember what the thing is called. But even with that, it's kind of like Eddie Murphy could sing, and the guy is quite a good singer. He's not like a great singer, but he's not a terrible singer. And in the context of the film, he's meant to be like an awful singer. And everyone going, God, this guy's awful. He's got a style all of his own. They even say, this guy's got a style all of his own. But it's not so bad that it's this sort of like, maybe there's a bit of vanity creeping through where Eddie Murphy didn't really want to be seen to be like a bad singer. So he kind of he's an okay singer. He's not a great singer. He's not a terrible singer, but he's an okay singer. But the reaction in the scene is kind of, so I've never really understood scenes like that where you go, it's great that he's playing all these other characters. But, and at the time, I think Rick Baker's makeup was so sort of like cutting edge that at the end, when it kind of like comes up and it says Eddie Murphy is the old Jewish guy in the barbershop and he's the old barber and Arsenio Hall plays these other characters, at the time, like, people were kind of like, oh my God, what he did that, he did what? But I just you know, there's like scenes at the end when he's chasing it to the subway and you think there's loads of opportunities where you could do things with these scenes, you know. But what you actually have is you have a very long 45 second shot with no music of the woman that he's chasing going through the turnstiles, and then him arriving at the turnstiles, not having any money. So he jumps over the turnstiles and follows her. And it's just this one locked off shot that's 45 seconds long with no music. Mm-hmm. And you just think, well, this is the opportunity. This is an opportunity for a regular romantic comedy to do sort of like an action sequence, you know, where there's some cutaways and you have her running down the stairs, which they have, but they just use it after. They tell everything chronologically in the order that they filmed it, it seems. We've got that shot of them going through the turnstiles, right? They're both through. Now they're going to go to that shot of them both coming down the stairs. She gets on the subway, and then in the same shot, he comes down, has a bit of difficulty with the door. Whereas what you would do, what you'd think you'd do to add some sort of tension, mm-hmm. is you'd have her coming through the turnstiles, going down the stairs, him getting to the turnstiles, not being able to get through, her getting onto the subway, cut back to him jumping over the turnstiles and running down the stairs and just having a bit of difficulty. And then if you wanted to, you could add a thing with the police that go, hey, he hasn't paid for his subway ticket. The police will come along, and then they'll chase him. And then the police chase him down, and they get onto the subway, and then he's got to get through the subway to get to the lady, and then the police check. Do you know what I mean? It's just kind of like you build up this thing, and then he has to sort of like say this earnest speech tour on the subway with all of like the local with all the people on the subway listening in, and then you got the police, and maybe the police have got their guns out and they're kind of like, hey, you jumped the subway barrier, and he has to do this earnest speech under all of this stress, and he tells her how he feels, and maybe she rejects him, maybe she takes it, but then the police go, oh, he's all right, we'll let him off, and then you've got kind of like an element of sort of like, do you know what I mean? And there's none of that. Every time there's an opportunity to do something in the film, it's kind of like they don't do it, and so
the
I find
it could have been more dynamically edited.
It could have been more dynamically edited, more dynamically directed, and I think it's kind of like, I think Three Amigos works every time you see it. I think it's funny every single time. But with Coming to America, it's not that I don't like it. I really like it. I think it's incredible. It's impossible not to like Coming to America.
Yeah.
But even the scenes where they're swearing in it play as so gentle that it's just kind of like you go, okay, so for me, the film sort of washes over me and I'm kind of, yes, fine. So I saw Coming to America the next day and I think there is a story and I think it does do something more than just do callbacks. What I thought it was absolutely spectacular in doing was it made me absolutely nostalgic and love a film that I'm not nostalgic for or love. You know, whenever there was a return character, whenever there was a return character or a reference to the original film, I was all on board, 100%. I loved it. I loved it. I thought Coming to America. Now, what I would say is, wasn't a big fan of the Sun character.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets a lot of screen time.
Sure.
And I think that they didn't have to do anything, right? All they needed to do was show up, go through the motions, do the same bits over and over again. And I think most people would have gone, yeah, fine. Okay. That's all you can expect from a movie that's 33, a sequel that's coming 33 years after the original, right? Mm-hmm. You literally just turn up, go through the motions, do it. They didn't. They did try and do a story, and they did try and do a sort of modern story about letting your daughters take over and kind of like not being a burden to tradition and kind of being open-minded about the future. And I thought that, yeah, that is a film that is worth telling. And for this sort of film, it's sort of unnecessary. But they did it, and it didn't feel particularly heavy-handed. So I think they told the right story, and I think it was a different story that they were telling. But I just am not sure if they told it the right way. I think that the daughters could have had a lot more screen time, and you could have given the son a lot less screen time. Even though it's kind of like a flip of the original where it's about his father's relationship with his son, it's about his relationship with his son. I think you get that, and you could have kind of like branched off. But all of the jokes, or I would say, 70% of the jokes, they landed. I thought it was really funny all the way through. I loved Eddie Murphy, loved Arsenio Hall, loved Wesley Snipes, loved all of the returning characters. I thought maybe the first 20 minutes up until up until the moment where James L. Jones exits the movie, right? I think everything just works amazing. I thought the whole celebration sequence that they have at the beginning, I loved everything about that. There's loads of cameos in it. Every time there's a new cameo, I was like more and more excited about it. Loved it. Then sort of like the plot kicks in and Eddie Murphy kind of takes a bit of a backseat, which, you know, as you say, is kind of like egoless, but also he took a backseat for some characters that I didn't really care about as much. Mm-hmm. So then you have the plot, and then at the end, it sort of like all comes together again at the end. And again, it's like doing, and you know that he's saving like a big sort of like treat for the end. Because you're going, he's not turned up yet. What's that going on? And I just thought that it all worked really well. And I prefer, you know, I've got no hatred for the original. I just find it a frustrating film because with every scene you're going, why didn't you? Why wouldn't you? You know, what did I watch?
That's good,
watched...
but it surprises me. I just would have thought when I spoke to you the other day and you just watched the first one again, I was thinking, well, you're just not going to like this one because it's all nostalgia for the first film.
No, that's the thing. I mean, the stuff that works, I love all of the Rick Baker characters in the first film, the Eddie Murphy, Rick Baker. I love them all, right? I'll give you two examples. I watched Jack and Jill.
Yes.
Which is the Al Pacino's best film, probably. So I watched the Adam Sandler movie Jack and Jill, which is a film that has, it's got a lot of jokes written into it. Yeah, they're not necessarily good jokes, but they are jokes. And you can tell when they're telling jokes. And it's got like Adam Sandler dressing up as another character, doing a thing, pretending he's someone he's not, you know. So when you watch it, I think Jack and Jill is pretty much, I mean, the jokes are awful. And it feels like a very lazy film. I mean, it's famously one of the worst films ever made. I don't think it is. I don't think it's one of the worst films ever made. I think there are worse films. But I would say that the majority of Jack and Jill is terrible. One of the things that gets criticised about is the trouncing of Al Pacino's legacy. I think Al Pacino's great in it. And a lot of those jokes wouldn't work if it wasn't Al Pacino playing Al Pacino in that film. I even like the Dunkin' Donuts bit.
That bit is, I mean, I'm sure we've talked about this, but it's also like he doesn't, if it was a lazy performance, it wouldn't work. But the fact he put so much into it is sort of what makes it a good Al Pacino performance. He really does it properly. He does it for real.
What people sell Adam Sandler short on is how surreal some of his jokes are. And like some of his jokes are just absolutely like crazy. If you watch something like Mr. Deeds, you know, there's a joke, or it's not even a joke, it's just a bit when all of the servants come out and do kind of like this weird sort of like, they go, oh, and they all do this call to each other on the balcony of his luxury apartment. And it's just this really weird moment. They all start singing David Bowie on a plane. And there are all these like really weird sort of like surreal moments in Adam Sandler films that, why I like him. He's not just doing kind of like crap jokes. There are kind of like some surreal weird jokes in there that I think actually take effort and some level of intelligence to think about. When you see Jack and Jill, like the whole concept is like this surreal weird concept where they've kind of like gone, Adam Sandler's going to do a movie, it's called Jack and Jill, and it's where he plays his own sister. You go, great, we know what that is. So then they've got like they've got like a contract with Pepto-Bismol. They've got a contract with Dunkin' Donuts. They've got a contract with a cruise liner. And then they've said to Al Pacino, do you want to do this film? And Al Pacino's probably gone something like, well, Jack Nicholson did a film with you a couple of years ago. He says that he really enjoyed it. Very much like Henry Winkler's approach to doing pantomime in England. He goes back, tells David Hasselhoff, Pamela Anderson, next year they're doing it. Right, so people always have a good time on an Adam Sandler film because the catering's brilliant, and they all get paid loads for not doing much. And you know, the film was $79 million. That's how. No, and that must have all been spent on their wages. Do you know what I mean? And like it's Al Pacino. It's kind of like we'll give Al Pacino $10 million to be Al Pacino. He gets to watch a basket. Most of it's on green screen as well. And then he does like this Dunkin' Donuts advert at the end. And you kind of go. So all the stuff that sort of works in Jack and Jill, people say Jack and Jill is a terrible film. It's an awful film. I don't want you to think Jack, Nick Helm likes.
Do you love Jack and Jill?
It's not a guilty pleasure. I just think that people say it's the worst film I've made. And there are, I think Adam Sandler's made worse films since. So I think there are moments in that work. I don't think it's a better film than the original Coming to America.
Right.
But I laughed at it more. Right. So there, it's kind of like this weird thing. And then on top of that, I watched The Cable Guy yesterday. Right.
Oh, yeah.
So The Cable Guy is one of those films where Jim Carrey got paid 20 minutes. It was originally meant to be a Chris Farley movie. Then I think Chris Farley went and did Black Sheep instead. And then Ben Stiller was directing. And if you look at it, it's got so many like Ben Stiller regulars in it. And so Ben Stiller was directing, and then he got Jim Carrey, and Jim Carrey came along. He got paid $20 million. And if you look at Jim Carrey in The Cable Guy, I think it's sort of like I probably enjoyed it the most yesterday when I saw it. But I don't love it. I saw it at the cinema. I know, and I've kind of gone off Jim Carrey over the years. But then when you watch this film, he got paid $20 million. And you see him in every scene, and he's adding value to absolutely every single moment of the... There's never a scene where he just walks into shot, does his lines and walks out. There's always something that he's doing that is either character driven, or, you know, there's a little bit of slapstick or something. And he's adding everything to that. And you just look at that and you go, yeah, sure. He was the top. He was the biggest comedian, one of the biggest stars on the planet at the time. He got paid a lot of money, and you can kind of see that he hasn't just kind of taken the paycheck with that. He's actually put in a performance. I think it's a really weird film because it could kind of be a very broad Adam Sandler-esque comedy, but it's directed by Ben Stiller, who at the time was like an indie filmmaker. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the pacing to kind of like what would be a slapstick sequence, like the basketball sequence, is filmed kind of like this really dark kind of indie movie with Jim Carrey doing Ace Ventura bits in it. And it's sort of like, so the tone is little, I really quite like the tone, but it's this weird mishmash of like indie filmmaking, really well put together shots that you won't normally get in a comedy of that era. And of like the broad sensibility of Jim Carrey, and when it all mixes together, it doesn't quite work. But having said that, you watch Jim Carrey in that film, and he's like bringing moments to every single thing. So when you watch the original Coming to America, and you just see scenes that haven't been milked 100%, like run dry for moments of humour.
Yeah,
it's kind of like a bit when Arsenio Hall comes out of the door, and James Earl Jones is there, and he doesn't want James Earl Jones to go in the flat, and he just goes, "Can I go in the flat?" And he goes, "Oh no, you can't." And then you go. And it's the third time in a row James Earl Jones has gone to the wrong bit, and they haven't. And it's so slow the way it's put. And you kind of like going, I don't. I can see that. I can see where there could have been a joke. I just can't see why, as it is, it's funny. Anyway, loved Coming to America, the second one. So I don't know, but I do think you've got to see the first one.
You're right, though. I think there's an element to it where you're talking about the editing, and you were saying the other day about how, you know, you've got Eddie Murphy playing multiple characters in it. And yet you've got people, the editing, cutting from one person to another as their dialogue ends. And even to sell the makeup, it would have made more sense to cut not on the end of the dialogue, cut halfway through someone speaking or something. It would have sold the makeup better. And the idea that, I mean, I don't know how much of a surprise it would be to anyone, but the idea that I'm sure you could watch that and not know how many parts were played by Arsenio Hall and Eddie Murphy, and it probably would have sold that much better if the editing was much slicker, that you wouldn't have noticed the join at all.
It's not just that, it's pacing. It's kind of like if a shot flows into another shot, and you've got two shots of people talking to each other, and if you use a reaction shot and then you use the sound of the other person talking, and then during that sentence you cut to the other person, it flows. And it kind of like gives kind of like a flow to the cuts and the editing. When you don't do that, it feels like it's an assembly cut where you're pasting bits next to each other. There's one really great shot in Coming to America where you've got, you're in the barbershop and you've got Arsenio Hall, Eddie Murphy, and then the old Jewish, old Eddie Murphy barbershop guy, and then the old Jewish guy, also played by Eddie Murphy. And the camera does this thing where it sort of like pans round, and the old Jewish guy goes behind old barbershop guy, and then Eddie Murphy walks in through the door as the king, right? And it's not like the most complicated shot ever, but it is a shot that you would use in a regular scene where, out of the five characters, three of them weren't being played by Eddie Murphy, right? So if you just had any normal scene, it's the sort of shot that you could use without it being a special effect shot. Uh-huh. And it's shots like that that aren't kind of like, hey, look at me, I'm doing this really clever shot. It's just like a normal, regular shot that you would normally use that sell it as a special effect, because it makes you forget that, oh, look, there's three guys that are all the same people. And so it's kind of like the, there's the fucking, there's the stick fighting scene in the first Coming to America, which you played basically straight with about four camera angles. And then you've got the stick fighting scene in the second one, which has got energy to it. There's no real jokes, but it's kind of like you're not feeling the jokes because you're feeling kind of like there's a sense of action and tension and energy. And it's kind of like, oh, right. So I just think as I think as a film, the way it's directed better. And I think it felt it's what's the name? Do you remember the name of the director? He did Dolemite Is My Name.
Oh, I don't remember. I didn't know it was the same director, actually.
Oh, it's the same director, because they got, I think they did a screening of Dolemite Is My Name, and then on the way back in the car park, Eddie Murphy, as they're getting into their cars, just said, do you want to do Coming to America? because he was so happy with Dolemite.
Well, I said that it's almost the fact that, you know, Wesley Snipes shows up again almost feels like a callback to Dolemite Is My Name, because it's they feel like such a team already.
Well, Eddie Murphy was meant to play the Wesley Snipes character, and then you can kind of like go, yeah, that would have worked. But yeah, then they went, oh, do you know what? Who would be really good? Wesley Snipes. So you got Wesley Snipes having kind of like, and Wesley Snipes started off doing comedy, and it's kind of like, you know, he's great. Anyway, we've got to play a song. We can talk about this after. I'm not saying we can't talk about this after, Nathaniel, but we do have to play a song. I'm sorry.
Okay. Just this once.
Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
We're back. And of course, answers on a postcard. It was Craig Brewer directed Dolemite Is My Name and Coming to America. That's really annoying. Alice Cooper had that album, Welcome to My Nightmare, which was the sequel to Welcome to My Nightmare. And it's kind of like, it's just impossible to actually have an out loud conversation about it. You have to... Yeah.
To really emphasise it.
You have to develop a new way of talking, don't you? What is it? It's like, look who's talking to. And it's kind of like, it's like, look who's... A Nightmare on Elm Street also. Well, Die Hard again.
With Teen Wolf 2, that sort of makes sense though, doesn't it? That's also... Jason Bateman is also Teen Wolf.
I think it probably makes more sense with Look Who's Talking.
Makes the same amount of sense, surely.
No, I think you can use Look Who's Talking in a sentence. You could go, oh, look who's talking. And then someone else could go, oh, pointing at another baby.
Sure.
Look who's talking too. You go, oh, there you go. But with Teen Wolf, you wouldn't point at Teen Wolf and go, Teen Wolf. And then you would go, and there's another Teen Wolf. You wouldn't go, Teen Wolf too, as in also. There was a sequel to Splash as well called Splash 2, as in... But she wasn't called Splash, she was called Madison. So it should have been called...
Who's in Splash 2?
I don't know.
I don't know if I knew about that.
I think Splash was Touchstone, so that was Disney. And then Splash 2 was Disney. So Touchstone was Disney's adult arm, where they did sort of like slightly more grown-up films. And Disney would kind of like do the animated stuff and some live action films. But obviously, I mean, Disney made a film about a mermaid, but it wasn't a kids film. It's got John Candy doing jokes about how large his penis is and stuff. And so when they made the sequel, they made it for kids. But I haven't seen it. So Craig Brewer did come to me. Yeah, I just thought it was... it does exactly what you said, but there you go.
Yeah, I assumed you were going to really dislike it, given that you weren't as fond of the original.
Well, I don't dislike Coming to America, but if I was going to sit down and... You were like saying, if Coming to America was on TV, you would, no matter where it was, you'd sit down and you'd watch it.
Yeah, I think it's one of those films where if I caught a bit of it, I'd probably end up watching the rest of the film.
And I think that's the sort of... I think that I've done that multiple times with Nutty Professor, where whenever Nutty Professor is on, I'll sort of sit down. But not Nutty Professor 2. I don't even think I've seen Nutty Professor 2 from beginning to end.
Not sure I have. I thought Nutty Professor was fine. I remember it was his sort of... At the time, people talking it like it was a big comeback. And I thought it was all right. I was a bit like, it's all right.
I thought it was a huge comeback. I thought it was brilliant. But... I think what's great about it is Eddie Murphy as the Nutty Professor. When he turns into Buddy Love, you go, great, it's Eddie Murphy. You know, this is Eddie Murphy doing the Eddie Murphy show. Great. But when he's Herman Klump, he's just one of the most lovable characters ever put on film. And then when you put him side by side to Buddy Love, you just like go, oh my God, these are different. This is the same guy.
Same guy.
Same guy. Rick Baker again doing the special effects. Good old Rick Baker. I just got to say, if you don't follow Rick Baker on Instagram, you bloody should.
Do you know what? I don't know if I do.
He retired in 2015. And now he sort of just does like projects at home and does his daughter's Halloween makeup. And it's just kind of, some of the pictures he puts up are fantastic, but he's just redecorated his, his workshop. So he's painted it all and made it look like a gothic kind of mad scientist lab. But he showed you how he painted the doors and stuff like that. It's great. I love Rick Baker.
Can we get Rick Baker on?
Can we get Rick Baker on? I mean, he sounds like he's just doing a lot of decorating at the moment.
Yeah.
Sure. She says, sure. Great. We'll do that. We'll get Rick Baker on next month. And by next month, I mean week. What else have you been a fan of this week, Nathaniel?
I watched The Incident, which is a really good sort of little small movie from 67. I've never heard of it. My friend recommended it to me. And it's really like, it's... Martin Sheen, very young Martin Sheen, and what's the name of the guy who's in Bird with the Crystal Plumage, the main actor? It's them two playing some hoodlums, some roughs, and they get into it. Feels a bit like a stage play, and that's the only downside to it. And they basically get lots of different people from New York society, or New York, different people from different walks of life are all on a subway train. And Martin Sheen and the fella from Bird with the Crystal Plumage come along, and they terrorise one by one each person on this tube train, or subway train, as they're called in New York City. And it's really like, it feels quite stagey in a way, because it kind of feels a bit like when they're terrorising one of the couples or one of the groups on the train, it's almost like the other people don't exist. Whereas it feels like Tony Musante. Thank you, Natalie. But it's a really good kind of film of that era that feels very...
When was it made?
67. So it's before Badlands even and things.
So when was Badlands?
Is it 69, is it? Or...
So Martin Sheen's had like a kind of... quite an interesting career, hasn't he? So Apocalypse Now was 74?
Yeah, I think so.
Was it 70? Or was it later than that?
Oh, 79, I think, Apocalypse Now.
So I'm thinking of a conversation. So he made Godfather 1 in 71, 72? Then he made The Conversation. Then he made Godfather 2. And then him and George Lucas swapped their war pictures, didn't they? George Lucas was going to direct Apocalypse Now. And he gave it to Francis Ford Coppola so that he could direct Star Wars instead. Star Wars was 77, Pocket's now 79. So there we go. Just off the top of my head, all that. Great stuff. But Martin Sheen had made The Little Girl That Lives Down the Lane.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I like that film.
Have you ever seen that?
Yeah. Again, that feels like a play, doesn't it? I'm sure it was.
So, I mean, he made, like, these kind of weird... Not weird, but they're weird when you get to the context that him and his sons have became kind of like this huge Hollywood dynasty. He started off making kind of like these very sort of like, well, what are they? Exploitation movies?
Oh. Yeah.
They're sort of like, if they were Italian, they'd be giallos, but they weren't. They were American. And he was, but also when you get to the 80s, he was like in The Dead Zone. And what was that other Stephen King adaptation he did? Was he in Firestarter?
Was he in that? I don't think he is in that, is he?
He's in a Brian.
Oh, he is.
Yeah, he sort of like turns up and he does sort of like, he'd already done Apocalypse Now by that point. So he was Martin Sheen. And then he was kind of like, he did a lot of kind of like supporties more. Well, speaking of which, he was in, he played like a support character in the movie Spawn, didn't he?
He did. And
he was in The American President as the president's aide. And it's, that was Aaron Sorkin as well, I think.
Was, yeah, Aaron Sorkin.
And then Aaron Sorkin went on to do The West Wing, where he went, who'd be the perfect president? Is it Michael Douglas? No, it would be Martin Sheen.
Martin Sheen. And similarly, doesn't Michael J. Fox play a quite similar character?
In Spin City.
Yeah,
it's kind of like, oh, yeah, I mean, it was weird at the time because you go, oh, yeah, it's basically their two TV series, TV spin-offs from The American President. So, like, Martin Sheen, it's kind of like... And then he was playing Charlie Sheen's dad in Wall Street. So it's kind of like, who is Martin Sheen? What was the thing that made Martin Sheen a star? Mm-hmm. Because he's always been, like, a star in my mind.
It's Badlands, right?
Yeah.
So, but then I guess, yeah, you're right, because actually throughout the 70s, you then don't feel like, what are these 70s movies that you kind of... It's all, yeah, you go from that and you go, well, he's a big star. He's in Badlands, which is late 60s. Then about 10 years later, he's in Apocalypse Now. So, yeah, it's not really, is it? A Wall Street? But again, yeah, he's but almost like he's supporting Charlie Sheen by then, isn't he?
But he got, I think he got an Oscar for Wall Street, didn't he? Or he got nominated.
Oh, maybe.
But it's kind of like, you go, yeah, Wall Street, he's supporting Charlie Sheen by that point. Oh. And then, you know, I remember when he did Spawn, it was just like, oh, wow, you got like Martin Sheen.
Yeah, Martin Sheen in this. Wow, yeah.
That's good. But, yeah, I don't really know. Don't really know why we keep going on about him, to be honest.
Also in the incident, though, is Beau Bridges. And he's someone you go, oh, yeah, in my mind, Beau Bridges didn't really exist till the 80s, even though Jeff Bridges did.
Well, I saw an interview with Jeff Bridges talking about his brother. And you go, yeah, well, me and my brother are kind of very competitive like that. Because he was talking about working with the Coen brothers. And he was like saying, I don't know if me and my brother. And I was thinking, oh, Jeff Bridges has got a brother. And I'm like, yeah, of course he's got Beau Bridges. Yeah, I've seen him in many, many things.
Yeah.
And them together in Fabulous Baker Boys.
It's funny that they're very competitive because I would have thought Jeff won that, to be fair.
I don't know if he said that they were competitive.
Yeah, quite competitive, us two.
I don't think you should take anything away from Beau.
No.
No. So what was that film called?
The Incident.
The Incident.
I'd recommend it. Yeah, it's well worth watching. And what else have I watched? I've watched WandaVision, but isn't worth talking about unless you've seen it.
Should I watch it?
It's all right. I thought I didn't really like it as much as it's. I like it in the same way I like all the Marvel ones, but I didn't get loads out of it. I know some people seem to have loved it. I thought it was all right.
I'm still gearing up for season two of The Mandalorian.
Sure.
Okay. Right. Yeah. Okay, I don't know. I'm just scrolling through because I've done my Twitter updates. What have I seen this week? The Insider.
Yeah, well, that was last week.
I think I saw that last week. Yeah, that's right, because I saw the Tyson Bruno documentary. Solo, Jack and Jill. I saw the David Lynch Art is the Art Life documentary.
Oh, yeah,
I saw it. I saw it 2 months ago. I didn't realise it was a film. And so I've included it on my list retrospectively. But I couldn't remember anything about it. Just, witches! That's what I saw, The Witches.
Oh, yeah.
Fucking hell. Like, fucking hell. The opening 15, 20 minutes is great. And you think, oh, we're all set up for kind of like, you know, an updated version of The Witches. I think the book is great. The Roald Dahl book, The Witches, is really creepy. I think I had it as an audio tape that my dad would play for us in the back seat while we were on long car journeys and stuff. Terrifying book. The film was always kind of, always felt like a little bit like a TV movie to me, because I think Rowan Atkinson was in it. He's definitely in it.
It's Nick Rogue directing it, who did Walkabout and
Earth
and all that.
Yeah, it always just felt like a TV movie.
It does, it really does.
It had Jim Henson puppets and stuff in, and maybe it was Rowan Atkinson, but it just felt like a TV movie to me. Mm. But having said that, I've got a lot of... I'm not like that sacrilegious, you can't remake it. But this... So I wouldn't consider this a remake. I'd consider this a readaptation. And they set it in Alabama. And it's like a largely black cast. And that's all great. That all works. The updating, the changing of the setting, the Americanization of it, because it was set in Britain, the first one. And then as soon as they go to the hotel, it's kind of like, it becomes this film that is about three talking mice in a conference room. And CGI. It just goes on for fucking ages. The CGI is terrible in a way that makes me think that it could only have been intended to be a 3D movie. And because of the 3D element of it, you're not really paying attention to the CGI. But, you know, when you've got the goggles on, you don't really notice that much. I just thought it was weird. It was just weirdly not very... It's Robert Zemeckis. And you just kind of like go, what is the... Like, the opening, great. It's about a bereaved kid learning to be friends with his grandma. Make that the film. Forget about The Witches. And then there's like this prestigious special effects shot where a cat is in one room, comes out of the balcony of the hotel, walks down the drainpipe, and he goes into another room, and it's all done in one shot. And it's just like this cartoon cat, and you're like, "What am I meant to be blown away by this shot? Because it's so badly done." Oh, I just, yeah. It was like watching an Alvin and the Chipmunks movie. Do you know what I mean? You've got three talking mice. They're all chatting to each other. And you're like going, I don't give a fuck about any of this. Do not give a fuck about this. So, yeah, fucking mental. I'm glad, because it's on Freeview now on Sky. I'm glad I didn't spend $17.99 on it. But fuck me. All right, we're going to do some fan mail now. Are you there? Are you there, Brian? Hey, boys and girls, how's it going? oh, Brian Johnson's here. My voice has got progressively worse week in, week out. But today we're...
It's a surprise.
It's a surprise. I'm here. Okay, podcast 65 in Malta. We're number 235 in Estonia. Hello, Nick, Nat, Brian, and...
Christopher.
I hope you're all doing all right on the lockdown. My question is for you, Brian. Oh, I was wondering whether you've met Jerry. Nick's holiday, Jordi Rodrigo, introduced us to on Fan Club many episodes ago. I'd love to hear the two of you have a bit of a chinwagger dog about anything, really. That was a long time ago. I think you'll find that I'm Jordi and Jerry was Scouse. Yeah, that's right. I've got my sunnies on.
had my sunnies on, had my shorts on.
Deep cut in it. It's a deep fan club cut, this.
It's going back away. I'm saying, Jerry, don't you find... That's right. It's difficult, isn't it? We had John Coulter on the other week. It really does highlight how what a skill it is. Just, anyway, next time I enjoyed the old thing, you introduced us on Fanboy many years ago. I'd love to hear that. Do you have a bit of a chat back? I don't want it, really. It'd be sort of tying and waving of Sooty and Sweep, although Sooty and Sweep don't talk in a couple of cuts.
Come on.
Ruined it. Anyway, keep it light, John. Tampa, Florida. Stepped on your pointy shoes there, didn't I, Christopher? Hello, boys. I was sad to hear you not getting any emails. Oh, fucking hell. This is poison chalice. I'm gone Welsh. Hello, boys. Get your titties out. That's what he says on stage. He's
good. Right, okay.
Maybe not in the next tour. Hello, boys and girls. I was sad to hear you're not getting any emails. Here we go. Great. I found it. I thought I'd better drop you a line. Hope you're doing better these days. I know being in lockdown isn't easy, but you both seem to be on a slow downward spiral. Please try to stay positive, because I enjoy listening to your show. Would hate it if you gave up. I live in Taiwan, which has been saved from the worst of the pandemic, so we can go to the cinema and everything here. Good for you. The last film I was a fan of was Big Little Women, Taiwanese melodrama about the three generations of women centered around the funeral of the estranged dad. It's a deliberate tearjerker, and even though I promised myself I wasn't going to cry, I ended up blubbing four times. It's on Netflix over here now. Do you like tearjerkers? When was the last time you cried watching a film? Lots of love, Tony.
I mean, it's a roller coaster, that one was.
It was.
Don't give up.
I know.
When was the last time you cried watching a film? I cry at films all the time. Can't remember when the last one was.
I can't remember what the last one was.
It would probably be within the last week. And Big Little Women. I've either seen that, but it's lost to the sands of time, or it's on my list of stuff to watch. Which isn't the same as seeing it, is it? Okay, we'll do one more, Natalie, and then we'll
have to save the rest for next week, I think.
Dear Nick and Nat, I really loved the episode with Henry Fraser. It was so good. It definitely put things in perspective for me. Your show is a great combination of funny moments and deep, meaningful stuff. It's a fine
that
star
week,
for me.
Be honest.
Thanks, Dominic. No, I think that I'm an avid listener, and I think that you do tip that balance, boys.
That's nice. Thanks, Brian.
Well, not you so much, Nat, but a lot of the things that you say, Nick, really hits me deep to my core. It cuts me to the quick, and I'd like you to know, Nick, that...
You've gone Welsh again. You sound like Tom Jones, Brian.
Never give up.
What is that?
So there we go.
All around the houses there.
Thanks, Brian. That's very kind.
He's travelled well, hasn't he? He does travel around the British Isles. I guess he's on tour a lot, so he probably picks up a lot of that stuff.
What are you saying? That my accent's a little muddled?
No, I'm just saying he must go on tour a lot, because he does.
Go on, tell me that my accent's a little muddled.
It's a little bit muddled. It's a little bit
tell
muddled.
Me. Tell me.
Your accent's a little bit muddled.
Well, so's your tan, Mrs. Doubtfire. So, okay, we're going to play a song now and get our fucking guests on. Absolutely amazing. Right.
Up in the morning, love, and the sunlight hurts my eyes, and something without warning, love, bears heavy on my mind. Then I look at you, and the world's all right with me. Just one look at you, and I know it's gonna be a lovely day. When someone else instead of me always seems to know the way, then I look at you and the world's all right with me. Just one look at you and I know it's gone.
Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're back. We're back live. We're not live. We're pre-recorded and we're back in the studio. I'm in my spare room and Nathaniel is in his washroom. We're joined now by some absolute fucking legends. So we're joined now by Michael Jai White and Gillian White. Hello, welcome to Fan Club.
Hey, thanks for having us.
How are you? You well?
Oh, we're wonderful.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's good.
Yeah.
Whereabouts on the planet are you?
We're in Los Angeles.
Yep, yeah, in the suburbs, in the valley.
In the valley.
Yeah, Sherman Oaks.
And then this is where you live?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And how bad is lockdown at the moment? Are you all at home all the time, or is it loosened
it's
up a bit?
It's kind of eased up a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, so you can go, there was no restaurant eating, but now there is outside in the patio type of things. Mm-hmm. And so we're enjoying that.
Yeah, yeah. Still got to wear our masks, but you know, we understand, we're okay with that.
Sure. Yeah. Are you big goer outers? Do you like going out and going to restaurants and stuff?
It's funny, we're kind of homebodies. We don't mind going out from time to time, but, you know, we don't mind being home.
Yeah, but I guess it's a combination of both, because we do get a lot of deliveries to the house. If this feels like the post office sometimes.
Sure. Yeah. But then I think that's sort of like retail therapy, isn't it? Where it's kind of, I've been I've become addicted to buying picture frames. I just buy picture frames. It's to the point where I actually ended up learning how to make picture frames because I was spending so much money on picture frames, I thought I might as well just get a skill out of it and learn how to make them. So I don't know why I'm telling you this.
Well, I noticed that you're
We're just imagining these picture frames.
Oh, yeah. Oh, great. I should have brought some on to show you. You've got a film that's coming out on DVD and digital on the 29th of March, at the end of the month, called Take Back. And it stars you, Gillian, and you, Michael. So tell us a little bit about that film.
First, let me tell you this, because I'm going to keep getting... You're going to keep getting me kicked in the knee, right? Because it's pronounced Gillian.
It's a hard G.
Oh, Gillian.
Yeah, oh, sorry. Because Gillian and Jillian are spelled the same. One is English, one is Irish. I'm the Irish version, the hard G.
Do you know what? We spent so long making sure that we got Jai right that...
Yeah,
we went up and fucked Gillian.
Yeah.
Cool, great. Well,
back to your question.
So when did you make this film? Have you been? I mean, not going back to lockdown, but this film's coming out now. Had you finished this film before the pandemic started, or was this something
during?
Yeah, we shot during.
Yeah, absolutely. It was the first film we did. First film we know in this area, maybe around California, mm-hmm. that shot during the pandemic, and man, it was a little rough. We had to take tests every day, and there's a lot of stringent rules.
Yeah, we had to cut characters out the script because it wasn't, you know, only a certain amount of people were allowed on set at a time. So it was a lot of changes that we weren't used to, but we did it. Got a great film out of it.
Well, I noticed there's a shot in the coffee shop where I noticed that people were wearing masks, and I went, "Oh wow, it must be must have been filmed really recently."
Yeah.
Some pickup shots.
Yeah. We had pickup shots, and it was really interesting. How many days it was? It was pretty fast, film when we shot it, mm-hmm. and really hot.
Very hot. We shot in Palm Springs in the desert. One day it was like 119 degrees.
Several days it was.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It was crazy.
Yeah. And it's too bad you can't tell on, you know, when you look at it.
Yeah.
It's just like, you know, there was like a little disclaimer saying it was hot as well this day.
Yeah. I was like, I've never drank so much Gatorade and water in my life between takes trying to stay hydrated.
Sure, because you're married, that must have helped with the bubble as well, right?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah. We were able to do all of our scenes together because, you know, we had been quarantined together.
Mm-hmm. And so you must. So this isn't your first film you've made together, though, right? You've been in other. This is your third.
No, our fifth.
Fifth.
I think there's a couple of things that we.
Yes.
Yeah, in one of the movies, we don't have any scenes together, but we're in the same movie.
Yeah,
right.
But this is technically our fifth film together.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, the one before this one, she was a terrorist, like fighting me.
Welcome to Sudden Death on Netflix.
Yeah, but we played husband and wife in another one.
Uh-huh.
I was the husband and she played the wife.
Yeah.
Right.
And
then we're back down. I played a publicist.
Yes, love interest. So
yeah, love interest.
Yeah, we're kind of working on a record here.
I know. Yeah. This is like Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers or something. It's that sort of. You've got that kind of, you're in every film together.
I like that.
We'll have to incorporate a dance routine in our next one.
Yeah. But is that, I mean, I guess you obviously enjoy it, or it's nice to work together. But,
we love working together.
I mean, you know, we're just lucky. I mean, we're best friends, and we, you know, we're like a cult team. You know, so I don't know, we kind of lucked out on this one.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So did you know each other for a long time before you were married? So you've been friends for years and years, is that right?
Yeah, 25?
Yeah, 25 years ago we met.
Wow.
Yep. Yeah. At a club.
At a club.
In an alley. No. We met at a club. It's like, you know, it's just one of those things. Yeah. Like, you know, it's like I you know, her friend was speaking to me, and I kind of, you know, looked around her friend and was like, "Hey, who's your friend?" So, so you know, I married the girl from the club.
From the club.
Yeah.
And I know times. I was going to say, I know you, Michael, as a martial arts. You're a martial arts expert. I know you from lots of martial arts movies. And Gillian, I wasn't sure that you were such a huge martial arts star. But within 5 minutes of your screen time, you are you're kicking an assailant down with a gun, taking the gun off them. Yeah. What's your experience of martial arts, Gillian?
Well, my husband started training me, so we about eight years now.
A lot of years ago. Like it's funny because. And she was like one my grand experiment. We're sickening because we do everything together, everything. And so she's always we worked out together. She's my workout partner. And then when we do martial arts, I mean, you know, I'd be doing it. I'd be teaching her. But I taught her on an advanced level without her knowing. And so
she had no idea.
She had no idea. Like I'm teaching her techniques because she has no frame of reference. She didn't know what was advanced or what was not. And even though, like, I'd have her doing something that I wondered if she could do, and she would do it because there was no margin for her. And, you know, secretly, I'm like, oh, my God, I can't believe she did that. But, you know, and I would tell my martial artists, do you know I've had her doing a hook kick, axe kick combination with the same leg? And they're like, no. I'm like, I'm serious. Like, but so she's, you know, she developed and trained with me. Like she passed black belt level like 3 years ago, really.
Well, I've got a similar story actually, because when I was about 9 or 10, I used to do judo and I did it for the longest time, but I never went into any competitions. Yeah. Uh-huh. And then I'd done it for about 3 or 4 years. And so I'd gone from being a white belt, I did one competition, went up to yellow belt, two dan for my first competition. So it's a similar story. So I'm similarly a martial arts expert. Okay. I won't try and prove it, but I've got some of the skills somewhere.
Yeah. Good.
Well, it was great because everything you taught me, eventually I was able to incorporate it into, you know, acting.
Yeah, her only frame of reference was me.
Yeah.
And so I would teach her things to where she could kind of like counsel me, like, you know what I mean? You know, like just little, you know, like intricate technique stuff. To like, so she could be like, "Oh, Mike, your base foot turned the wrong way," like that kind of stuff. So
you know, as a partner now, you're almost of a similar skill level, or you can match each other.
It's actually really funny because I have so many people tell me they're like, when they see me doing stuff on screen, they're like, "Man, you had the same look as your husband, or you did it just like your husband." I'm like, "Well, hey, there you have it."
Yeah, and so for years, like she's been helping me with seminars. Like we did a whole tour in Australia, and she was my partner in that because trying to teach even advanced black belts certain techniques is very difficult for them. But she'd been training with me for so long that she was my aide, and she's helping teach like black belts who've been doing it for 20 years. And so, and it's funny because she doesn't even realize it so much, but then they're like, "My God, like, how does she get like that?" You know? So it's kind of like, you know, a little secret weapon over here.
So when you have like an on-screen fight with each other, are you choreographing it yourself based on what you're capable of doing?
Yeah. Then we usually will train at home prior to filming. And then when we get on set, we got it down. So we're just ready to go.
And do you kind of like, you know, like when, you know, kids do a play in front of their parents in the kitchen, you know, you get the, you say, look what we've been working on. And everyone comes around and they watch you do your fight.
Well, it's so normal for the kids because, yeah. I mean, we work out and they're working out too. I mean, we've got, you know, our daughter is like an apprentice black belt herself. So that's just normal.
Sure.
Yeah.
So, Michael, you know 8 martial arts, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So when you're teaching martial arts, if you're switching between Taekwondo and Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, are you kind of like doing kind of like a mishmash of everything all at once, or are you keeping all of the disciplines very separate?
Well, I usually keep them pretty separate until it's a character or something in a movie where he's touching on different things. oftentimes I'm playing somebody who maybe like kind of, I don't know, elite trained. And so I could use different disciplines that would fit that. But usually it's about the character I'm playing. I've done like wushu kung fu for a lot of years, ever since I was like 14. I have yet to really do much of that discipline until I, you know, like maybe if I'm in that's something that I kind of did a little bit when I did a few movies in China. But, you know, that particular discipline is very flourishing, very big and broad, doesn't really lend itself to a lot of the regular combat fighting. So it depends on the character, and I'll kind of, you know, kind of brush off that discipline for that particular movie.
One of the interesting things about this film is that the characters in the films are also martial artists. So it's a good reason that you can kind of bring that out. It's very, very handy for the plot that you're actually able to do that without it having to be an explanation.
Right.
Yeah, it was amazing because when we first had the script brought to us and we were offered the roles, we were like, was this written for us? It, you know, this husband and wife that are martial artists and train together, but the script had been written, you know, well before us. And
it was ironic. It was like, nobody's going to believe that we didn't, that this wasn't written for us.
Yeah, that we'd have something to do with this script.
Yeah.
You know. I think I assumed that you'd kind of generated the story or you generated something about it.
No, we didn't. It was all, actually the writer is a martial artist.
Yeah, so he wrote it.
Yeah, the writer's a martial artist. I don't know if he's married or whatever, but he wrote the story as two martial artists, you know, a husband and wife, and the husband teaching a martial arts class.
And Michael, did you ever consider doing it professionally?
What's that?
A professional fighter.
Oh, absolutely. Well, kind of. I've been around the fight world for a lot of years. So a lot of my best friends have been fighters, and I've lived vicariously through them. A lot of my friends, when they were training for big fights, I'd be part of their camps. I had boxer. One of my best friends was a boxer, and all the martial artists, but I stepped back from that, and I kind of looked at it from a distance, and I said, well, I don't know if that, it didn't have enough to me. Even right now with the UFC, being that's the biggest worldwide martial arts kind of fighting league, it's still kind of fringe, you know? It's like only the people who follow UFC know who these people are, even at this day and age. And so back then, it was really... It really kind of thankless, you know. I knew people who were world champions that, you know, if you weren't part of that league or, you know, a martial art nerd, you wouldn't know who they were, and they couldn't really, you know, they weren't making very much money, you know. So my thing was, I always loved to compete against the top guys for me, you know, to live that and test myself. Getting paid for it and actually going, like living the life of a fighter was nothing that was attractive to me.
So you played Mike Tyson in 1995?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And obviously he's a boxer. Did you have to learn boxing to play Mike Tyson?
Not really, because I'd already kickboxed. And like I said, my best friend was the super middleweight champion of the world, who was a stablemate of Mike Tyson. And so I'd been training and boxing with, like, you know, the top trainers, like Joe Goosen and Freddie Roach, and also Emmanuel Stewart prior to doing the movie. So, yeah, I was quite adept at boxing. I just had to emulate the Mike Tyson style for the movie.
You said that you would fight him for free, didn't you?
Yeah, I would. I mean, like I said, for years, when my friends are in are training for a fight, they need sparring partners. And just like I've done this with Layman Brewster, who's a former heavyweight champion. He knocked out Klitschko. I train and box with people like that. And that's a joy of mine. And so I offer it up. If Mike Tyson was getting ready for another fight, I would gladly be one of his sparring partners. I would love that. So that's nothing about, you know, not about a purse or anything else like that. That's just a win-win situation.
So it's just about playing with the best. You want to be with the best in the world.
Absolutely. I mean, there's not that many really good heavyweights. I know what I'm doing. I've studied him for 20 years. So I kind of familiar with him. And I think I could have a lot to offer, you know? So that's what it was. But it just kind of spawned into this whole thing, like I'm challenging Mike Tyson, where it's like, no.
Do you both get that the same way with acting? Do you like kind of playing against other sort of actors that you can kind of, if you're playing with really good actors, I guess you also improve your own game, right? And it feels like is there a competitiveness even within acting?
Not for me either.
Mm-mm.
No, yeah. I just think people who are really good actors bring it. They make it better for you because their reality bounces off of yours, and so you forget that you're acting. Mm-hmm. That's what I love about it. It's never a competition. I never understood the competition part because unless you're playing the same role, how are you competing?
Right.
You know what I mean? But
I guess that also does show, doesn't it, that if everyone's good, like if you're playing against good people, then everyone's going to be better.
Yeah, and absolutely. It's a win-win situation because if you're in a film together or a scene together, it only makes everybody look good.
Yeah,
everyone is up to par with their acting.
Yeah, that's why with us working together, oh my God, it doesn't feel like acting. Like, you know, and so, I mean, even when we're playing, even bickering or anything else like that, it's like, you know, the playing off of each other and the nuances that you play off, it's like, doesn't feel like, I mean, when we were watching the movie, it's like, I don't know about you, but it's like, it's almost like I forget that we did the scene because it felt just like
how we are.
Yeah.
Just if we have a conversation in the bedroom, that's how it was on screen.
Yeah.
And this film, talking about actors, also has, you know, Mickey Rourke in it, who feels like a very kind of iconic actor playing the big villain of the movie. Well, what's Mickey Rourke like in real life? What's he like to work with?
Yeah.
He's great. I mean, I was just so excited when I found that Mickey Rourke was coming on board. I was like, oh my God. Because he, like you said, he's iconic. I mean, look at his resume of films and how long he's been acting for. Mm-hmm. And he's such a good villain. And it was great for me to have to play off of that because he's so good as a villain. It made my character like real, because I hate him in the movie. He's pretty much ruined my life. So, you know, it was great to be able to, bring that to life.
Yeah, I mean, Mickey to me is just like the last vestiges of like when Hollywood was great. You know, he just radiates such a persona. I remember when he did, what was that Zack Snyder movie? But even under the makeup, he just...
Oh. Sin City.
Sin City.
Yeah.
He just has this thing that I feel like, man, we're losing, you know, as that generation goes away. I mean, it's great to see somebody who has that thing still.
Yeah. Mm. It's a certain depth. You know, it's not surface.
Yeah.
You bring a certain depth to the character.
Yeah, man. Yeah. So, you know, I've gotten to work. I mean, it's funny. We go back a long ways. The buddy, my best friend, the former boxer, was actually good friends with Mickey, and we used to all hang around together way back in the day. But that's like, you know, like I've known Mickey for a while indirectly, but so you know, it was great working with him this time.
I'd forgotten that because he was a boxer, wasn't he? For years.
Mickey gave up acting at the early 90s, late 80s to become a professional boxer, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. Yeah, and I was, you know, like, I was right there. I remember when Mickey was sleeping in the gym. He was really devoted, you know, and that's one of the things that is, I think, a cornerstone of those kind of actors who just submerge themselves in a lifestyle, or just there's a code that they live by, or they can live or die by. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, is the essence of what makes him interesting and what makes him special, because he brings that to the characters. Mm-hmm. There is a line that this character will live and die by. And there's a commitment there that you really don't see or believe in a lot of the younger actors these days.
Yeah, he definitely has a real presence, doesn't he? So he doesn't have to do a lot, but yet you kind of find him terrifying. He's just got this presence. He doesn't have to say anything.
He believes it.
Yeah.
He believes it, and therefore you believe him.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So that's, you know, and I was lucky to work with him twice. Like, we did this movie, and then he did a movie, like, what, with me that I was the lead in, mm-hmm. about 3 or 4 months after we finished ours.
Yeah.
So, oh, wow.
Yeah.
So when did you finish this one?
Is it August?
Well, if you say it's August, you might be right. I'm terrible. I'm clueless.
So, you know, we finished the majority of it in August. I had to leave for Atlanta to shoot a TV show for 3 weeks. And so we stopped it. And then as soon as I was done with the TV show, we came back and we did a few of the pickup dates for like maybe 4 days.
I'll go with what you, I mean, yeah, like she's like great at that. I can't remember what happened last week.
Yeah, so I'd say our last pickup days were in September.
And you've both worked with Quentin Tarantino, right? And on Jackie Brown and Kill Bill Volume 2.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were both cut out of Quentin Tarantino movies.
Isn't that funny? He was cut out and I was cut out.
I've seen them both, though. They're all on the kind of...
They're all on the kind of, special DVDs.
Yeah.
Special edition.
So what's it like being cut out of a Quentin Tarantino film?
Disheartening. No.
You know, at the time, Quentin and I were friends, right? Mm. So he had written it. There was a really big portion of the movie that I was supposed to be in. And it was supposed to be the entrance to the Bill character. And it was this big set piece at a casino. And I was this sword carrying tuxedo, like very much like James Bond tuxedo, sword carrying guy that was running the thing. But while he was in China, he called me up. And he said, "Hey, man, you know, I got this idea of another way to actually show the massacre at the church that happened, like during the wedding." And he says that might be a better entrance to the Bill character. And I couldn't deny. I was like, "Man, you're right, man. I understand. You know, friends first. This is better for the movie." And then later on, he said, "Man, I still want you to do this fight scene. I want you to fly out here and do this fight scene." And you know, when I got there, and it was like, you know, he still wanted to do the fight scene with Bill as a flashback. And we all used to always kid around. He and I would play the Chinese characters. And I'd be like, "Hey, where do you think you're going? I'll kill you." You know, that we would do that all back and forth. And then the day of the scene, he comes with these handwritten dialogue and says, "Hey, we're gonna do it like the old Chinese movies." I'm like, "Are you kidding?" And he's like, and he shot it like that, and that's why I'm talking the way I am in those.
But it, you almost have like an Australian accent or something in it. They've dubbed it.
It was kind of like they were. I think there was a New Zealanders that used to do all the dubbing.
Oh, really? Okay.
Right. And, you know, so it's like, "I've been a teacher for over 22 years. And more comfortable." They all sound like that. So I grew up with that. And so when he cut it out, I was like, I wasn't mad because I was sitting there going, "How does this fit in the movie?"
So, but I guess that's it. They've put it on. I mean, it's the only deleted scene that they seem to have put out.
But I mean, I don't know. I kind of felt like, you know, like he felt bad and wanted me to come down. But it was a ball. But I've never been angry about that decision. I love movie making and storytelling, and I didn't quite understand that. But I appreciated the gesture.
There's something quite similar to Kill Bill about this film as well, right? With Mickey Rourke maybe as the kind of Bill character. He does seem to have this kind of control over your character, Gillian, just from this kind of time he's had with them. Tonally, they're very different. But there's a sort of similar... I can kind of imagine it being, if you like Kill Bill or something, I could see you getting something similar. It's a similar story, but told in a completely different way.
Yeah, well, there definitely is that control factor, especially, you know, the fact that I've gone on with my life, but haven't told my husband. No one knows my past. Mm-hmm. So there is that control in a sense, because I can't be honest. Mm-hmm.
But it also, it's also a film that's got sort of a social conscience to it as well, isn't it? Absolutely. And it's about domestic violence and sex trafficking. And is that one of the things that sort of appealed to you about making it?
Oh, yeah. You know, I love working on any project that brings to light a very relevant and important subject. You know, sex trafficking goes on all the time. It's not something that's always talked about, only in a certain circumstance that might be on the news, but it's an everyday thing. I mean, we have daughters. I hip them to all kinds of stuff all the time. I'm like, you have to be aware of your surroundings. You cannot be on your phone. You have to pay attention. Look at people. Look at what they're doing. Just pay attention because, you know, these sex traffickers, they just snatch people that quick. They snatch these girls that quick. So it's important that, you know, in the film, the fact that I was taken and now this person has taken our daughters. So it's, you know, it's, it hits, it kind of hits home, you know, the fact that we have three daughters.
Yeah. I know that that's sort of, I mean, I know that's sort of what Stallone ended up doing with the last few Rambo films was he picked sort of like, he picked an issue that was going on in the world and then he made sort of like an adventure film around it. But really it's kind of like shining a light over here. It's kind of like, you know, using your skills and your ability to kind of like make films, but then also shine a light on an issue that maybe kind of get swept under the carpet a bit. I thought that was a really great, interesting part of the film.
Well, thank you. That's kind of how we want to do. Yeah. That's personally like how I like to choose any kind of action films. There's going to be the action quotient that will take care of itself, that will preach to the choir. But outside of that, I think if it's an action film, the way I look at it is if you take the action out of it, is it a good film? Is there something for, you know, the non-choir type of person? Right. And this is something that, that actually ticks that box. And, I think that's what makes it a full, you know, full-rounded film. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's every element in this film, every element.
And one of the big news stories in this country, and I imagine in the States as well this week, has been the Prince Harry, Meghan Markle interview with Oprah Winfrey. And one of the things that came out of that was talking about Tyler Perry, who had put them up in one of his homes and given his security to them. And I know you've both worked with him. Is that the kind of generosity of kind of spirit you kind of associate with him?
Yeah,
he's extremely generous. You know, he looks out for the people he cares about.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've been a friend of Tyler before he was Tyler Perry. And it's amazing. There's a combination of this mogul and he's a very simple guy at the same time. You know what I mean? Like his work ethic is like, I've never seen anybody like work as hard as him.
You wonder when he sleeps.
Yeah. But if there's an issue that, I mean, it's one of those things that he's like, oh, that's not right. Let me do something about it. Yeah. And he just, you know, in his way, he just goes directly at it. Mm-hmm. You know, so, I mean, it's never surprising. Like with the guy that was Jeffrey, that used to be on...
On the Cosby Show?
Yeah, on the Cosby Show.
Right.
And he was wrong. Tyler's like, we'll have none of that.
Yeah.
He just goes, hires a guy.
Roll on the show.
And, you know, makes a statement. And instead of sitting there and talking about, well, that's not right, he just does it.
Yeah.
You know, so that's the simplicity of how he goes about things. He just goes directly at it. And this is another situation where I think Tyler just said, like, that's not right. Let me do something about it. Right.
That's Jeffrey Owens, wasn't it?
Yeah.
From
Yeah,
I guess that's true. I guess that's all those things we can always watch things and think what a terrible thing that is. But part of the best way to deal with it is just to do something about it if you possibly can, I guess is the answer.
Yeah
he doesn't talk about it, he actually acts upon it. So that's an amazing quality to have.
I'm a big fan of Black Dynamite, Michael. And you're so great doing comedy. Me and Nick come from stand-up backgrounds, and it does feel like it's it's great to see the kind of martial arts thing, but it feels like it's such a gift. I'd love to see you do more comedy. Have you got anything in the pipeline?
Oh, I do. I have a movie called The Outlaw Johnny Black, which is which is basically the next iteration of Black Dynamite.
Right.
When I first did Black Dynamite, I wanted to do these three kind of in the blaxploitation genre kind of thing. Is the hyper action thing, Black Dynamite, and another Western, which is Outlaw Johnny Black, and the third would be like the horror movie, like the Blackula, like that type of thing. But we are done with it with the Western, and I got to say, I'm very happy about it. It's got amazing stars in it.
Yeah.
This lady's in it as well with me, and produced it with me. And we got something like close to 30, like, you know, very recognizable.
Yeah,
like
very well-known actors.
Yeah, so, yeah, so that's coming. And if you like Black Dynamite, you'll be happy that we're on that train again.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
Yep. So something that might be called Blacker Dynamite may be coming pretty soon.
I just think it's such a well put together movie, and it feels like, even though you know it's kind of a spoof, there's something about the way it's filmed and the sort of the color palette and the production design. It completely fools the eye that it does just feel like it's totally a film from that era, the early 70s or something, right down to things like cigarette machines and things feel like you watch it and have to keep telling yourself, oh, this isn't from the time. And you almost, you laugh at something, and that's the point where it tells your brain that, oh, this isn't actually a movie from the early 70s. This is,
right.
I love it. It's a great movie.
It comes from a loving homage.
Oh, yeah.
Movies. And so, you know, that's something. I mean, I think the guys from Stranger Things, they got it right, where you had a genre, you had something that was so alive and so in that moment that even though a young audience weren't there to experience it the first time, but they still get all the nuances and the feelings that we got when it was fresh and
in
new.
In the 80s.
Yeah, so that's the kind of way that I like to work this. Mm. Yeah, so, you know, the lovers of the genre and in that period get to relive it, but a new generation gets to experience it the same way we did.
Yeah.
So that's the idea.
So have you started filming this Western yet, or is that?
Oh no, it's done. Oh, yeah. It's done.
It's done.
So, yeah, it's done. So,
just in post right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how hands-on are you? Are you watching dailies and stuff? I mean, are you watching?
Yeah, I'm the director, writer. You know, and. No, it's enough of me in that thing.
So this is all you, yeah?
Yeah, it's kind of like the, you know, the makers of Black Dynamite do a Western.
Yep.
You know, it's very much like authentic to that time where you've had the, you know, you had the Shaft, but then, you know, he follows it up with Shaft in Africa.
Sure, yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah, sure. And so, yes. You know, the film company have a hit, and then they move on to do their next thing. So,
of course, yeah.
Yeah. Very much like my heroes from your country, the Python guys, you know?
Sure.
You know that, you know, life, you know, you've got Life of Brian that followed Holy Grail. And, you know, so it's that team and it's that humor.
It's very similar sort of sense of humor, and it's really because you've got jokes in the dialogue, you've got jokes in the background. It's there's jokes coming from every direction. It's a terrific film. I love it.
Yeah, I've got things in Black Dynamite that's completely lifted from Monty Python. Honestly,
he's a huge fan of Monty Python.
Yeah. Yes. big. Yeah.
And. One of the things we were asking you to, we were asking about your favorite songs, and we played Lovely Day, which is your choice, wasn't it, Gillian?
Yeah, I love that song. The kids know, they're like, Mom, that's your feel good song. I'm like, yep, always puts me in a good mood.
Do you have any other associations with it? Do you remember when you first heard it or anything? Or
No, I honestly can't. It's just every time I hear that song, it's on the radio and a movie. It's something about that song that just lifts my spirit. I don't know. It's a weird, you know, certain songs, they just make you feel good. And that song has always done that.
For me, that's a song that I always just wait for. I always wait for the long note at the end. That always feels like you're waiting for.
I know. And
just
I,
that
and
kind
I
of countdown. How many?
Hold the note. I try to hold the note and see. And then I'm like, oh.
Well, I was. I went out for dinner with my family, and it was my sister and her husband, and my mum and my dad, and my girlfriend. And we were all sat around this big table in a restaurant, and I just go, "Well, thank you very much. That was a lovely day." And my mum and my sister and my girlfriend all sat around going, "Lovely day, lovely, right. lovely day," and. My dad and my sister's boyfriend, husband, just stared at me like they didn't know what the fuck I was doing. But all the women around the table instantly leapt on that and were like, yeah, we'll join in. That was fine. Yeah, it's a great song. One of your favourite films here is The Princess Bride.
It is.
Both of ours.
It's so funny. We didn't know that that was our... And one day we just happened to say it, and he's like, that's my... I'm like, me too. I'm like, I love that movie.
That's kind of like, that's sort of like an introductory level for people that haven't quite decided whether they like Monty Python yet. It's kind of like a gateway. You, if you like Princess Bride, you'll probably like Monty Python.
Yeah. I just love the levels.
Every level.
Just everything. There's a very intellectual level, then there's a silly level.
And
you know,
of course, there's the romance.
Yeah, and then there's the abstract stuff, you know, which what made me really love Monty Python, because you know, they just had the nerve to just be ridiculous sometimes, you know.
It works as a lot of things all at once, you know. It's kind of like, I watched it when I was a kid, and then I've watched it again as an adult, and you kind of get totally different things out of it. And it's a kid's film, it's an adventure film, it's a comedy, it's a pastiche. It's like, and it's based on a book as well. So it's kind of...
Yeah. But it's also, you know, based on people's knowledge of movies, because, they, you know, the storytelling, and they poke fun at storytelling sometimes. Mm-hmm. Just like with the end of Monty Python and the end of Life of Brian, it just goes, screw it, here's the end of the movie, we'll throw all of this shit at you. And if you look at the end of Black Dynamite, I did the same exact thing. It's like, screw it. You know, beats up the president. His girlfriend runs into the room. How does she get to the White House? Who cares? It's like all of that is just totally influence of Monty Python.
Yeah. I think I'm going to watch Black Dynamite again tonight. I can't... It's gonna happen. It's gonna happen. No, I love The Princess Bride. I saw it when I was a kid, and it came out. And I used to go to this. I think Nick used to go as well. To the over here, there was a children's cinema club at the Barbican, and one week they had it as a preview. And we're all kids, and none of us knew anything about it. And it's such a great way to watch a movie, just going in and just being like, we don't know what it is. It's a new preview of this movie. And it was just that. And it was like nothing I'd ever seen. But like you say, it was nothing, but it was also like everything we'd seen before, but sort of poking fun at itself and great jokes. And, you know, it's sort of, it's very much like it plays on your own, on kind of genre tropes that you know are going to happen. But then if it twists it or it doesn't do that thing, it's suddenly like you think you know what you're watching, and it keeps turning. Every scene is great. I love it. What a great movie.
I was going to say, let's not... we've only got like 10 minutes left. Can you talk to... Gillian, can you talk to us a little bit about what it was like working with Spike Lee on Bamboozled?
Oh, boy. It was... I mean, well, once again, another icon. He is so focused. And I remember even when I auditioned, he was so on me in the audition. I actually left the audition in tears. Because I was like, there's no way I'm going to get this part. He just kept forcing me to be better and be better and be better and do it again. And the audition, I walked out that audition like, oh, my God, I didn't get it. I blew it. A week later, my agent calls me. Yeah, you got the part. I'm like, what? I thought he hated me. You know, but that's just how he is. He's on you. And he was, you know, he's on every bit of you during the film, the process, the rehearsals. It was great. You know, just to say I was in a Spike Lee film is awesome to say, because he's had so many classics.
Yeah.
Right, one of my favorites.
he's someone who's endlessly impressive because he seems to, you think of him and you know that he teaches and he does all this stuff, and yet he still seems to produce a new movie every year, almost like clockwork. It's sort of, it's sort of astonishing, and to have done it for 30 odd years, it's quite, it's quite astounding.
Absolutely.
One of the things that about the Take Back that I loved as well is the scene with the pizza cutter. And as soon as it happens, you think, oh, I'm going to be, every time I use a pizza cutter now for the rest of my life, I think that's what I'm going to think of.
Yeah.
We were like, you're never going to want to use a pizza cutter.
Yeah, that's one of my little things that I threw in there. Because like, with the action, I rewrote a lot of things in the action. And I was like, haven't seen this before.
Yes.
So I threw the pizza cutter in. There was actually a scene that we were like later on where, you know, the pizza cutter thing pops up of where, you know, we're, you know, where I don't want to use it. Like she, like, pizza comes up and we're like, and I'm like,
nah.
But that does, that feels like, again, it does feel like a very kind of iconic moment. And it is, it surprisingly think, oh yeah, I've never seen that before. It's always great to have something you just think, never ever seen it. And now you never.
You know, hey, it's a lot of things you would use if a situation like that happened. You're going to grab what you can.
Oh, I thought that scene was great. When you grab onto the handle and then he grabs you and then you pull the drawer out and then you use the drawer as a shield. I thought that bit was great.
Yeah, stuff falls on the floor. You don't know what and what she grabbed.
Yeah. I don't know if I've mentioned this, but I've been making a lot of picture frames, and they have.
You have to send us one now.
there's this cutter. It's a paper cutter. That's like a pizza cutter.
Yeah.
And, and it's really great, Nathaniel. It's like a Stanley knife, only. It's like a pizza cutter for paper. And when I saw that, I was just kind of like, I wonder, would that work as like a defense thing? It was great. My other favorite bit was the bit at the end when you turn up, Michael, and the guy tells you to put your gun away.
Oh, yeah. So, what are you doing with that thing?
Yeah, sometimes it's improv and stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, and it works. Because, you know, I so wanted to play a character that was not like...
Not tough.
That you normally see me doing, you know what I mean?
Sure, so, yeah.
And those glasses worked, like, amazingly.
Yeah.
Because it just, for some reason, just those glasses just kind of cut me down a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I noticed even in the training sequences you're wearing them. And I was sort of like going, oh, yeah. But I was also a bit worried that you'd get hit in the face and that your glasses would break. I was kind of...
You'll both know this, but it almost feels that whenever you meet anyone in real life who's great at martial arts, they're often the calmest people you'll meet. And they're never, ever going to be people that feel threatening or anything, because they know that they're absolutely fine. They're not...
It's nice to hear you say
that. Everybody's so damn scared of me.
Everybody's scared. They think he walks around kicking people in the head and beating up everybody on the street.
Yeah, it's the weirdest... This thing, I could be talking about the most innocent thing in the world, and they're like, man, I hate to get in a fight with you. Like, why is that on your mind?
Well, we were scared and we're meeting you on Zoom.
I'm happy to hear that, because I always say I'm the last person that would lose their temper.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So. But there is always that sort of, there's often a serenity, isn't there, about people who are very good at martial arts and things that feels kind of unusual.
Yeah, the ones that have dealt with their demons, because hopefully with martial arts, as in, you know, even the armed forces, the most lethal people are at peace.
Yeah.
It's the ones that are still have the chip on their shoulder, that have something to prove.
Right.
I'm not going to mention other people's names.
Go on.
Some martial arts stars that you might have heard of, and you know. You know, because it's like, if you've really kind of gone through, you know, kind of walk the burning sands, you don't have to do that anymore. But those who skip...
Well, you don't have to prove yourself.
Yeah, who skip around it, they have to prove themselves all the time. Hmm. And, you know, and I feel sorry for them, because they're not at peace. Hmm. You know, it's that. It's like there's far more dangerous or like, you know, security guards, you know, that will be likely to use excessive force than a Navy SEAL or MI6 type of, if that really exists now. But you know, somebody who's really a tested warrior, yeah. they're calm.
Exactly. I always find that.
Nathaniel, because we're coming to close to the end, Nathaniel worked in a comic shop and I grew up watching people work in comic shops. I was such a huge Spawn fan in the 90s and when the film came out, and I remember going to see it at the cinema. Have you got any particular memories of making Spawn?
Oh yeah, it was quite rough. I was happy to, you know, to have done the movie. I was a bit claustrophobic before that movie and had to get over it. but yeah, it was a hell of an experience, and just there's so many lasting lessons from doing that movie. It taught me some, you know, it kind of like reminded me of stuff that I had to work on doing stage, you know, emitting the character beneath everything, because I had to emote. I had to tap into the humanity of the character without necessarily using my external tools, you know? Mm-hmm. And it had to be something internal that people had to connect with. And so that was like a really good exercise for me to bring out the humanity of this hideous creature so that people can follow this this hero's journey. So yeah, it was great for me all the way around. And it was a challenge, but something that I really cherish.
That makes a lot of sense, because I guess you'd need someone like a martial artist or someone like a mime or someone that can use their body or something to sort of tell a story, because you're so limited. Yeah, of course. Or an actor, yeah, you could have an actor. Yeah. That's true. That is true.
Yeah, it goes back to Phantom of the Opera. Beauty and the Beast, that kind of, you know, you have to touch into the humanity of that character, and you know, when you can't use your looks and everything else, you know, stuff, so yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean that's incredibly obvious now that you mention it, but I just thought of you as Spawn. But then you're only not, you know, absolutely covered in makeup for maybe 10% of the film.
Yeah, probably even less than that. But I've learned, you know, that was such a learning thing, because it was very, I had to do most of my stunts. It was so easy for you to look like a guy in a suit if you behave just like regular people. And so sometimes my stuntmen didn't understand the internal qualities of the character. And they could just sit down and, you know, whatever. And it's not, you had to not, you had to, you know, you had to present yourself as otherly, you know, otherworldly in all, in the way it moves and everything else. And so that was like a hell of a learning experience. Because, I mean, when we see the stunt guys or, you know, they say, there's something not right with this. It's not, this. And I had to wind up doing stuff, and it looked different because the internal ethos of the character. So yeah, that was a big learning thing. And it's one of those things that goes without people really knowing or really appreciating. I mean, they appreciate it subtly, but they don't know why.
Yeah, yeah. It's a subconscious thing.
It's a bit thankless, but it has to, but it's so necessary.
Mm-hmm. We've come to the end of our hour with you. You've got time for a game with Nathaniel, but just to say that your film Take Back is released again on DVD and digital on the 29th of March. And now, Gillian and Michael, I'm going to hand you over.
Can I say one thing? Because I would be remiss not to mention this, because I hope you guys realize the historical significance of this movie. Do you realize that this is the first African-American or Black female martial arts action star in the history of films?
Didn't realize that.
Well, yeah, this is, and then this is the very first interview about an African-American lead female martial arts star ever. And so I'd be remiss not to mention that we're embarking on history right now.
Because, that's incredible.
Yeah, this has never happened.
And I had no idea. He brought it to my attention, and I was like, wow, you're right, I
guess. Yeah, so everybody always goes back to, wait a minute, Pam Grier? But no, she wasn't a martial arts, you know.
Yes, yeah.
So as in the vein of Bruce Lee, Chuck Norris, Van Damme, all the leading martial arts action stars, she now goes on that mantle, you know? And so forever. And that's what it is.
Do you think do you think you'd have enjoyed it differently had you known that going in, Gillian? Or are you glad that you didn't have that pressure on you?
Yeah, I'm glad I didn't have that pressure on me, because I think you didn't tell me right away. You told me like after.
Yeah.
Which is a good thing.
But did I know it right away? Yes, I did.
Oh, well, great. Congratulations. Okay, I'm going to hand you over to Nathaniel now, and he's going to take over for the last... Sorry about this. He's going to take over for the last 2 minutes.
So
go for it.
Gillian, Michael, this game is called Better or Worse, and you have to say whether the next person is better or worse than the person before, based entirely on my own opinion. And I've done this week with fictional characters because I kept thinking, you might know if I did it with famous people, you might know them personally. So I'm starting with Superman. Is Batman better or worse than Superman, based on my opinion?
Better.
Is Superman better or worse than Batman?
Mm-hmm. I think Superman's better.
Batman's better, I'm afraid. It's Batman. Sherlock Holmes. Is Sherlock Holmes better or worse than Batman?
Is Sherlock Holmes better or worse than Batman?
He's worse.
Is Sherlock...
worse.
Michael and Gillian, I'm going to have to hurry up here.
Ebenezer Scrooge. Better or worse than Sherlock Holmes?
Ebenezer Scrooge? Yeah. Worse.
Mickey Mouse. Better or worse than Ebenezer Scrooge?
Better.
Mickey Mouse, way better.
Better. I would say better.
He's better. Darth Vader. Better or worse than Mickey Mouse? Darth Vader.
He's worse than Mickey Mouse.
Yeah, he probably is worse than Mickey Mouse. Daffy Duck. Better or worse than Darth Vader?
Darth Vader
is worse than Daffy Duck.
Daffy Duck's better. Daffy Duck is better.
He's better than...
Bugs Bunny, better or worse than Daffy Duck?
Bugs Bunny's way better.
Well, he's a bit of an asshole.
He was a bit of an asshole.
Whoa, you heard it here first, guys.
Okay.
I agree. Daffy Duck, Bugs Bunny is worse than Daffy Duck.
Yes, I think so.
Correct. Yes. Donald Duck, better or worse than Bugs Bunny?
Better.
Well, now I'm questioning because I like Bugs Bunny. You guys made him seem like a bad...
I think Donald Duck is an asshole, if we're going for assholes.
Donald Duck was an asshole.
Yeah, he's worse. He was worse.
Yeah, Donald Duck was worse.
Wasn't he decent to his girlfriend?
Daisy Duck, yeah. Daisy's girlfriend, sure.
We haven't got time for this, guys. Come on, keep going.
Popeye, better or worse than Donald Duck?
Who?
Popeye.
Worse.
Oh, Popeye's
a mutant.
He was better.
Popeye is worse.
I think Popeye's better. I'm saying Popeye's better.
Popeye's better.
And Kermit the Frog, better or worse than Popeye? Kermit the Frog.
Kermit the Frog?
Oh, he's better.
Kermit the Frog was a sweetheart. Yeah. He's better than Popeye.
Yeah.
He's better. He's better.
Yeah.
You got to go Tom Hanks to beat Kermit the Frog.
Okay.
Exactly. First will beat him.
Is that the score?
Hey, you got an eight.
That's a great score.
Eight out of ten, which means that Michael Jai White and Gillian White, they're not as good as Jen Brister, Thomas Coombs, John Coulter, Jason Manfred, Joe Scadelli with 10, David Baddiel, Ken Cheng, Mike Drucker, Harry Hill, and Ronnie with 9. But they are as good as Matthew Crosby, Susie Dent, Charles Esten, Henry Fraser, Eddie Hearn, David Hepworth, Jason Isaacs, Simon West. This is very average, guys. John Niven, Magical Bone, Samantha Morton, Matt Okine, Miranda Raisin, Griffey James, Chris Stark, Stu Whiffen with 8. And you're better than Richard Herring, James King, Ludi Lin, Henry Normal, Janet Varney, Johnny Vegas with 7, Gary Delaney, Neil Frizzell, Frank Harper with 6, and poor old Dave McLean with 5. So you did very... It was good.
All right. You get, like, one of your picture frames as a consolation prize or something?
Sure.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, everyone. Stay safe. Look after yourselves. And to Mucka Jai White and Gillian White, welcome to the fan club.